Hey, it's the FinTech Newscast. Thanks for joining once again. And as always, you know the deal. It's Steve. How you doing?
Same as always. How are you, John?
Same as always good, or same as coughing and fever?
Same as always good. Just trucking, keeping on trucking.
Well, what's going on these days?
Well, I wonder, John, given the fact that the US is sort of in a bit of a crisis right now, would you consider moving to Canada?
I love Canada. I don't know. It's like what is that annoying t-shirt? America's hat.
America's hat. Yeah, I love it. Well, you may be in luck because the Bank of Canada recently advertised a position for digital currencies economist.
Well, I wouldn't qualify for that job in particular. I was thinking more like lumberjack or something like that.
Something more manual. Well, if you did qualify, you could actually be involved in the team that's looking to create a digital currency for the Canadian dollar, which is pretty interesting. And it kind of points to the fact that a lot of more central governments are looking into creating their own central government-backed digital currencies.
Yeah, I had seen that Canada was doing some research into this, and they're not going as far as doing testing or pilot projects. They're kind of like this, doing just modeling on how it would work, and I think working with some of their academic institutions.
Yeah, I think they're looking for somebody who can basically keep an eye on the market that's, in terms of cryptocurrencies, stable coins, crypto exchanges, CBDCs as well, and just sort of help them understand what the landscape looks like so that they can eventually get into the space. I'm assuming in the
So
next, 3 or 5 years.
there would be one job that would be the economist for this, huh?
I think it'd be one job. They apparently also hired somebody else as well. They hired somebody else to be a project manager for the same sort of purpose, but this would be sort of the leader in that team, right? The person driving the change.
I love these new kinds of jobs that never existed before. And I should keep a list of these kinds of jobs for when somebody says, "Well, what about the coal mining jobs? And what about the buggy whip makers? What's going to happen to them?" Well, these
Yeah.
new things exist. We're not going to
They're
be all be as many haberdashers as there once was.
Yeah, I have a cousin who was born in the 2000s whose job now is social media manager. And I don't think that was a thing when he was born, right?
I thought
20,
you were going to
21
say
years ago.
haberdasher, but yeah.
Haberdasher, yeah. That's a
Yeah,
different cousin.
yeah, exactly. Yeah, I always tell people just prepare, build up your skill sets and your learning ability. It's never going to stop.
Be flexible, especially when it comes to digital currencies.
These horseless carriages might go somewhere someday. So we have someone on the show this week that happens to be looking at the future all the time, I think, for his job, right? Stephen Ehrlich, Director of Research, Digital Assets at Forbes. Great to have you on the podcast.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So, speaking of new roles that never existed before, how did you end up as the Director of Research for Digital Assets?
That's a great question and a great segue. I've actually been in Bitcoin or the cryptocurrency arena in one shape or another really since 2013, near the end of my days. I think Steve and I share this together at the Department of Defense, sort of looking at it from that point of view. And ever since then, I left. I joined a boutique consulting firm in New York called Spitzberg Partners. I headed up their technology practice, and that's when I really started to kind of see the broader potential of cryptocurrency and even almost even more importantly, the underlying blockchain technology. It really offered two things. One, a way to disintermediate a lot of financial intermediaries, and I get the irony of this talking about it with someone who works at a bank, but at the same point, I know they're at the forefront of a lot of interesting developments as well. But then also sort of an inversion of how the internet's set up, where as opposed to being dependent upon major technology companies, the Googles, Amazons, Facebooks of the world to manage all of our data and really have them almost know us better than we know ourselves. Blockchain technology offers a way for people to sort of regain their identity, their financial sovereignty, and really kind of take back control of their lives. So I got really excited about that. I was a consultant for about 4 years looking at use cases for this technology in financial applications, data storage, identity, social media, healthcare. I actually spent a year at Citibank as their lead digital strategy analyst. So I saw a little bit of how the traditional industry is sort of thinking about crypto and fighting back. I spent a year as the COO of a nonprofit organization designed to that advocates for the comprehensive adoption of blockchain technology across capital markets called the Wall Street Blockchain Alliance. And then from there, I went to work at Kraken also for a year, a little bit of jumping around. For those of you who don't know, Kraken's the second biggest cryptocurrency exchange in the US. So they're doing a lot of really cutting edge things. But my background is as sort of an intelligence analyst, as a research analyst. And I really like, I mean, Bitcoin is as much a political trend as it is a monetary one, a data innovation. And I wanted to find a position that would kind of let me kind of blend all those different parts of my career and expertise. And I actually was a contributor at Forbes for the last 2 years. So I've been writing articles on the website, but they're looking to scale up their coverage and really kind of put a flag in, I guess, in the sand as far as cryptocurrency reporting. So they offered me the position. I was really excited to accept. I couldn't say yes fast enough.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah, it's definitely an interesting role. Now, it's interesting you mentioned the Bitcoin, the political side of that. And I think people like me are a little bit hazy on that. Can you talk about a little bit of that aspect?
I guess probably the best way to start is, I mean, the issuance of money, the control of monetary systems has, at least since, I guess, like the 1600s with the Treaty of Westphalia, really been the domain of sovereign countries. Bitcoin was created sort of as a rebellion, not just against like profligate spending, overly dovish central bank policies designed to sort of bail out the banks in 2008, 2009, or even what they're doing today to help us during this recession, which, I mean, to be honest, I agree with. I mean, I would have probably done the same thing if I was sitting in Chairman Powell's seat at the same time, but in some ways it's a protest movement, and it's a way for people to, again, to regain their financial independence. It is, it's decentralized. So, and again, I'm just speaking about Bitcoin here, but that's decentralized. So there's no central issuer. There's no one that can shut it down. And there's no one, as long as you can get on the internet, you can get access to the network. So, so in that sense, it is a bit of a political statement as much as it is a financial instrument. And that's something that I find really interesting. I mean, again, I spent time working for the government. I believe in the nation state. There's a lot of good that comes with it, but at the same time, it's a hedge, and I find it very interesting to kind of think about some of those implications.
Yeah, it's interesting. You talk about in your recent article about China's efforts around CBDC, central bank digital currencies, and I see that makes sense, like inside of China, how that could take off, especially if it's a communist dictatorship. They just say this is it, and everyone has to use it. But I don't see it. I don't understand the case for outside of China when there's so little trust of a communist dictatorship that's kind of in conflict with all of their neighbors, and their unwillingness to make the currency convertible as it is now. What's the case on the other side that I'm not seeing?
Yeah, and to be honest, I think I agree with some of what you said. For any of your listeners that weren't aware, I wrote an article in Forbes this week, basically talking about how China, for one thing, China is at the forefront of a lot of financial innovation. I mean, as much as the U.S. Sort of almost relies on Google and Facebook and Apple to be brand ambassadors in China, it's Alibaba, it's Tencent, it's those major groups that are really kind of the leaders. And within China, as a way of sort of regaining I guess like their lost stature as like the center of the world, I mean, they're trying to dethrone the US dollar. with the yuan. And a big part of that is that they are creating what's going to be the first major economy sovereign digital currency that's expected to launch sometime soon. I mean, they've been doing trials for a while, and officials are speaking very publicly about it, and it's a big deal. The idea is to create a technologically superior form of money that's programmable, that can adjust interest rates automatically and do a lot of really cool things. I wrote the article to just talk about it's gotten a lot of attention to the extent that people are characterizing the conflict between the U.S. and China as a cryptocurrency or a currency cold war. And when I saw that characterization, I actually thought it was incorrect, because people like to talk about a cold war because it's a conflict that's not kinetic, that no one's shooting at each other. But at the same time, the U.S. dollar, I mean, it's a hegemon. I mean, and we can't take that lightly. I mean, China has a long way to go to dethrone the dollar in trade and as part of currency reserves, so on and so forth. And as you said before, I mean, people don't necessarily trust China. Their popularity has waned from coronavirus. Despite the fact that I think there is some, despite the fact that maybe they are getting a little bit of positive feedback just based on the recovery, but they've had a bit of a head start. But they're really trying to leverage their economic muscle through like the Belt and Road Initiative and other efforts to try to internationalize the yuan, make it convertible, and we'll see what happens. I mean, one thing's for sure: the dollar's not going to stay the world's reserve currency forever. Something's going to unseat it, whether it's Bitcoin, whether it's the yuan, whether it's Libra, Facebook's digital currency. I don't know, but it'll be interesting to follow.
Steve and I share a background in that we both work in intelligence for the federal government before sort of going into the private sector. So we're really focused on the implications of, you know, what essentially is global politics and great power politics and all this stuff. But I think that the fundamental issue here is that if you look at the Chinese Communist Party now, they're basically seen in very unfavorable light, as you mentioned, by basically all of the world, both their neighbors, the EU, the US as well. It seems like the tide is kind of turning against them. How likely is this project to unseat the dollar as the safe haven currency of the world, given their not great standing now in the world?
Yeah, I mean, I don't put the likelihood as extremely high, and that's part of the case I tried to make with the article, that I think a lot of people that are sort of calling this like a cold war, I mean, they don't appreciate how entrenched the U.S. dollar is. I mean, it's basically been a hegemon since the end of World War II. And I mean, it's funny. I mean, the dollar almost has a Teflon quality to it, in the sense that even when we screw up, when we cause the financial crisis, everyone still runs into the dollar. I mean, in March, when every market crashed, everybody ran into the dollar. I mean, that really is the safe haven of last resort. And it's going to take something monumental for that to change. I mean, either we're going to dissolve from within. I mean, maybe we have a controversial election and people lose faith in the credit of the federal government.
That'll never happen.
A civil war, yeah,
super
never.
Smooth.
Of course,
that's not controversial.
But one thing just to slightly keep in mind too. I mean China. The survey I said in the report, I mean, yes, especially among Western governments, I mean, China's popularity is very low, but it is a bit more favorable in emerging markets. Maybe not Southeast Asia so much, but Africa, Middle East, where they're using a lot of their wealth to sort of like give friendly loans and sort of engender goodwill there. And there's an effort to try to push a lot of that into like RMB denominated loans. So, I mean, maybe that will help. That's not going to unseat the dollar, but it's definitely something to keep an eye out as well, depending on how quickly some of these other markets can recover following the crisis. They don't have the same type of central bank flexibility that we do. So it could be difficult still.
So what do you see on the blockchain development side? Like you, I was really excited early on. I remember reading through the projects on the Ethereum Foundation website going, oh, this is great. All this stuff is going to happen. Well, why wouldn't it? And it seems like so many things have gotten stuck in this proof of concept, like the friend zone of the fintech world. aware. It just doesn't happen. It doesn't get released out into the wild. It just tested and then dies out.
Yeah, so there's a lot of really exciting things happening in cryptocurrency and blockchain. I mean, for instance, just to turn to blockchain first, and one of the things that Forbes does every year is publish a list that we call the Blockchain 50, which basically is a list of the 50 biggest companies in the world that are making meaningful use of blockchain. And that means like we don't look just for pilot projects that get a lot of press and perhaps don't have too much substance behind it. I mean, we're looking for companies, they need to have a minimum of $1 billion valuation to be considered. And we're looking for things in production. And some past members of the group include to be companies that, like in some ways, the standard that we use is that they need to be companies that our parents know. So for instance, like Walmart and Facebook and Alibaba, companies like that are using like enterprise blockchain, as we call it, to do things like supply chain financing, trade finance, supply chain provenance, data storage, all sorts of really exciting things there. And then in the open, the non-permission space, we're seeing a lot of clever financial engineering. There's a movement called decentralized finance, where basically people are building payment, lending, and exchange protocols on top of blockchains like Ethereum. Bitcoin is poised to do well this quarter. It crashed in March along with the rest of the market, but it regained those losses quicker than the S&P, NASDAQ, a lot of other global world indices. And just this week or in the last 2 weeks, we saw companies like Square and MicroStrategy and Stone Ridge Advisors all make significant allocations towards Bitcoin, minimum $50 million. Two of those companies made Bitcoin their primary treasury reserve asset, which is a big deal. So the progress, it can appear slow, but there's still a lot of things going on beneath the surface. And one thing that I always try to remind people, our subscribers, our readers, is that this is all still very, very new. I mean, the Bitcoin white paper was published about 11 years ago. So to go from that to where we are now is still light speed. It's just hard because sometimes people get so excited that they write checks that Bitcoin's or crypto's not able to cash yet.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So it sounds like you're more of a you're more on the positive side of Bitcoin, right? As opposed to being sort of a Bitcoin skeptic, like I think John and I may be, I think in some cases.
Yeah. I would have to be to take a job like this. But again, as a former intelligence analyst and somebody that I take a lot of responsibility in my job to make sure that I'm providing like meaningful, actionable reports and analysis to our subscribers. I'm not one of the people that I actually cautioned against investing a lot of these like decentralized finance products that exploded over the summer, because I didn't see yet like the right product market fit or for instance, some of the leading protocols, I didn't see that they had the right governance structures in place or strategy to be able to defend off insurgents. It's very important to be skeptical of any type of investment, including this. And sometimes people can get into trouble because there's so much abundance around it that it leads to FOMO. And plus the education gap is really high when it comes to crypto. It's something that a lot of people don't know about, even very smart people. Oftentimes if some of our readers want to invest, they don't know where to go. They can't go to their RIA or their fund manager because they probably don't have the integrations to just take some money out of gold or wherever and put it into Bitcoin. They have to do it themselves. It's a bearer asset, which means that if you have it stolen, you don't have very much recourse. And there's a lot of scammers out there. So I always tell people to be skeptical. I mean, yes, I do believe in its fundamental value, and I do think that it's going to stay, but I don't think there's much benefit in just being a rah-rah cheerleader day in and day out. That's more what marketers are for. That's not really what my role is supposed to be.
So don't buy all the hype and have a little bit more patience. It's coming.
Yeah, I mean, the goal should not be to 1,000x in 2 months and then retire. I mean, I guess that would be great.
But that's what I want.
Yeah, don't we all? But again, like, believe in the long term. It's really easy to think, well, if I only, like, if I put all my money into Bitcoin on March 16th when it was $3,800, I think Bitcoin was approaching $12,000 like today. Like, my God, I could have paid off my mortgage. I could have done this. I could have done that. But at the same time, like, that's not the time horizon you have for your other investments either. Bitcoin shouldn't be any different, or any of the other types of assets out there. I mean, there's thousands. I mean, there's probably only a couple dozen that are really worth anything, at least in my opinion. But I mean, that should be the time horizon, and you shouldn't treat Bitcoin or crypto any differently than any other type of investment that you make. You need to make sound, rational decisions. And my job at Forbes is to really, like, present, like, quantitative and qualitative analysis to sort of help frame those decisions for people.
Make sound, rational decisions. Yeah, I think that's solid. It's fair enough.
Yeah, that's a pretty basic but a great way to look at it. So you mentioned earlier a few of the use cases that you've seen using Bitcoin kind of move the ball forward. Right? You mentioned supply chain finance and others. And we've seen things that basically promise that, you know, they can end world hunger with Bitcoin. But what are some of the most interesting and applicable use cases that you've seen that you think will actually deliver value in the short term using Bitcoin?
Steve. Are you asking about blockchain, or are you asking specifically about Bitcoin?
Specifically about Bitcoin.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's a good question, and it's kind of an important distinction to make. I mean, I think that Bitcoin a few years ago, I mean, the value proposition there was like a cheap payments tool, remittance services. Essentially like disintermediating the Western Unions and MoneyGrams and so on and so forth. I think that narrative around Bitcoin has changed though, for a couple of reasons. I mean, but most importantly, because Bitcoin has still been plagued by a substantial amount of volatility. I mean, to be I don't have to tell two bankers this, but I mean, to be for money, you have to be a unit account store of value and medium of exchange. And it's hard to be a safe store of value if it could go up or down 10% on a given day, etc. Plus also the Bitcoin network, it's energy intensive, it's elegant, it's sophisticated, but it's also a little bit it doesn't have a ton of throughput at this point. I mean, it can only handle a handful of transactions a second compared to Visa, which I think does about 56,000. So Bitcoin's narrative has really, I think, shifted a little bit more towards like a store of value akin to gold, for instance. But as you're saying earlier about other use cases that are really exciting, there's tons. I mean, in the enterprise space, it's cutting in efficiency, supply chain, trade finance, data storage, auditing, all sorts of really cool things there. There's a whole cottage industry of people using blockchain to help make charities more efficient, give out medicines and vaccines to people, and making sure that, I mean, for one, the vaccines are what they say they are on the label, and then two, that they're getting to the right people, giving out things like universal basic income and validating people on blockchain through digital retina scans. So there's a lot of really cool things out there that can have been plagued by inefficient processes or are just too centric on centralized databases that can sometimes serve as single points of failure.
So it's really making progress across a number of industries and subsegments here, it sounds like. So if you could predict where either Bitcoin or the use of Bitcoin to all these use cases that you mentioned and how that'll be used in 4 years, what would you say? What would be the top three or four things that you think you would see in industry on a widespread level?
Well, for Bitcoin, again, I think it's going to be more an investment tool. I mean, there's going to be only 21 million Bitcoin ever created. And can either one of you actually, I'll ask you, do you know how many have been created so far?
8,324,000.
There is an eight, but there's actually been 18.5 million have been made. So there's only 2.5 million left to go. And its issuance schedule is set up in a way that we won't actually get there until the year 2140. But still, it's getting late early. So, I mean, Bitcoin's primary value proposition is as scarce digital value that's easily transferable, divisible, et cetera. I don't think that's going to change. But from a blockchain point of view, again, industries, I mean, looking at, even just COVID, I mean, trying to find better ways to manage healthcare records and distribute supplies. Cybersecurity, being able to track like admin logs and seeing if there's a breach, you can go back and make sure that the attacker can't go cover his tracks. Payments, stable coins, sovereign digital currencies, like a much more efficient peer-to-peer way of sending value. I mean, everyone, there's a running joke in the crypto industry that the cheapest way or the fastest way to send $20,000 between New York and London is to get on a plane with a duffel bag full of cash. I mean, it should be just as simple as that. And then social media, like there's blockchain applications to all of this in a way that we can like help people sort of like regain control over their identities or digital advertising. I mean, for instance, I'm guessing probably both of you use ad blockers. Now that I'm an employee of Forbes, I can't promote that, but I get that ads can be annoying. I mean, there should be a better way where you can get compensated for viewing ads, and maybe you can share some of your personal data so that they're more relevant, as long as you know that it's not going to be used in a creepy way. So there's a ton of use cases there, and there's smart people working on all of them. It's just really a matter of like finding the right product market fit, building the proper solution, and then doing it all in a way that still stays decentralized enough that it's different than what we have today.
On the blockchain side, I've been thinking of it as kind of like a Linux, like not a sexy thing that people in the street would know about, but kind of working beneath the surface in the back offices and the settlement rooms and all that. Is that a fair comparison?
Yeah, I think so. And there's a very strong open source like ethos to this entire industry. I mean, it has to be. I mean that's how Bitcoin was created, and that's the only reason it works is because blockchains are fully visible for anybody to see and verify that they've sort of maintained their fidelity. I mean, there's a very big movement towards a lot of the work, even in the enterprise space, has been built on top of open source technology. There's even a really interesting movement by Jack Dorsey, the CEO of Square and Twitter. I mean, he's a huge Bitcoin proponent, and he created an alliance to help create a library of patents that are like free to use so that they're impervious to patent trolls and things like that, to kind of help like continue along those lines. And actually I might be getting his title wrong, but the head of a project known as Hyperledger, which is one of the biggest, if not the biggest enterprise like blockchain foundation in the world. Yep. I think he was the former executive director of Linux or something like that. So to your point, I mean, there are a lot of similarities, at least between the ideologies of those two types of like databases and operating systems.
So it's funny that you mentioned the Hyperledger. I work with the Hyperledger now to some extent, and it seems like there's a lot of white paper discussions, a lot of use case exploration, but I haven't seen anything actually come out of the Hyperledger. And I know that it's basically all the big banks, right? It's JP Morgan and Citibank and maybe Wells Fargo as well. But again, it seems like there's sort of a gap between the enthusiasm and the promise of the technology and the actual relevant use cases, right? John and I always joke that there's always some new blockchain use case announced or some new Bitcoin use case announced, but
the PLC.
We never actually see what it comes to, which is interesting.
Yeah, and look, that there is a disconnect between sort of where people think this is and where the technology actually is. I mean, I think in the enterprise space, we're still very much in the building phase. In fact, the head of R3, one of, I guess, Hyperledger's co-opetors, for lack of a better term. He actually wrote an article in Forbes this week acknowledging as such as enterprise blockchain has kind of reached its 5-year birthday. He said that a lot of critics would probably say that it hasn't sort of met all of its expectations, and that's probably a little bit fair, but he kind of retorts by saying that there's a lot of one-time like build out costs that just, that there's no shortcut. Yeah, you have to do it right the first time. I mean, Hyperledger has dozens of products. So I can't really speak to everything that they're doing. I mean, yes, they have. They've signed up a who's who of major corporations, and they're doing a lot of good work. That said, there's also other projects too that aren't on Hyperledger. I mean, I know JP Morgan has an interbank information network that's used for to send data and do interbank settlements. I think it's like 211 banks set up that I think does real value. I know Ripple, I believe, has. I know they have dozens of companies on their network. So there is some work being done, but I mean, no one's under any illusions that blockchain has is like competing with Oracle yet or anything like that.
Given the fact that you're an expert in the space and you've worked both in trade associations and now you cover this space for Forbes, do you think that the best path forward to get to actual use of this technology will be via consortiums, like the Hyperledger and R3, or will it be through private industry? And maybe, you know, I'm thinking here of maybe like Ethereum or something like that. Is that which of those two paths do you think would lead to a better outcome and a faster adoption of both DLT and cryptocurrencies?
Yeah, so that's a good question. And to be honest, in the industry, it's been sometimes a seesaw between like the permissioned ledgers like Hyperledger or R3, and for any of your listeners that don't know, I mean, one of the big distinctions, the big distinction between permissioned and permissionless is that permission means that only vetted nodes are allowed to join. Permissionless, like Ethereum or Bitcoin or Litecoin or plenty of others, are open in the sense that anybody, if you have a computer, you can download the core software, sync up to the network, and start processing transactions. There's always a give and take. Sometimes we talk, because for some of the use cases, especially in the permission sense, they're very esoteric. There's some very unique features that need to be built. There's functionality, composability that has to be able to process this many transactions a second, has to be able to handle this type of document, read this type of document, has to be integrated with this particular type of asset token, et cetera, that our permissionless blockchains just aren't able to satisfy. At the same time, though, I mean, for instance, like Hyperledger is doing some work with Ethereum. There are discussions going on, and at some point, if all of these permission chains just become like their own little islands and they don't talk to each other, then what's the point of all this? And there needs to be some way for them to all link together. And I think that's where the permissionless chains can come back in. There's a lot of feeling out. I mean, even within like the enterprise space with consortia, the Hyperledger folks, I actually interviewed the VP of Hyperledger for a Forbes Blockchain 50 event a couple of weeks ago. And I asked her the question. I mean, sometimes they're almost like operating a dating service where there's a lot of companies that want to try do some sort of blockchain trial, but blockchain only works if you have a group of eight or some sort of consortia that's willing to work together and run nodes, and they kind of help bring these people together and identify use cases. And that's probably something that's unique for a lot of these companies. So it's a seesaw. It goes back and forth. I think we're going back now towards the permissionless space, just because there's so much excitement, and also it gets more press, because when we see price movements go up and down, like that tends to, Forbes writes about it, Financial Times, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, et cetera. But at the end of the day, I think there's going to need to be a way for all these different platforms to be able to talk to each other in one sense.
So I have one more question for you. What's the price of Bitcoin in 3 years? Okay, I'll make it easier. In 3 days.
If I knew the answer to that question.
Yeah.
I don't know. You see a lot of crazy prognostications. I mean, like where there's models saying Bitcoin's going to be like $20,000 by the end of this year, $100,000 by the end of 2025, $1 million by the end of 2025. If anybody really knew the answer, they wouldn't be working anymore. They probably would be smart enough not to tell anyone else. So I don't, I don't know. I mean, I do believe that it's going to go up. I believe that it has solid underlying fundamentals. It has a diverse user base, active developers, things like that. But again, the world could change. It could. I mean, there's a non-zero chance that it will go to zero. I don't think it's likely to happen, but but it could. So I guess like the last piece of advice I would give is if people want to invest, make sure you don't invest like anything else. Don't invest money that you can't afford to lose, because like you never know.
That's right. Sane and rational advice. There's no return without risk. That's for sure. Well, thanks for joining us on the podcast. Some really great information and a good update for us on Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks, Steve. How can our listeners follow you on either social media or your column on Forbes?
Probably the easiest way is just on Twitter, at Stephen with a V underscore Ehrlich. That's Ehrlich. That's probably the best way. All of my columns get posted there. Somewhere else to follow to, Forbes Crypto at Forbes Crypto on Twitter. That we post all of my stuff plus the rest of the editorial staff, and we have we have dozens of contributors that write content every day on everything from how to account for taxes when your crypto goes up in value to the future of sovereign digital currencies. So lots of really good stuff. Lots of really good stuff out there.
Amazing. Thanks, Steve.
Yeah, thanks a lot. That's Stephen Ehrlich, Director of Research of Digital Assets at Forbes. Please hit subscribe to keep up with this and the latest in fintech news. And thank you for listening.